studies are on the Gospel of Mark, using a relatively new commentary written by Ched Myers, whose name is on the board, entitled Binding the Strong Man. This is a fairly distinctive approach to Mark, as we'll see, quite different, actually, than you may have been accustomed to. And I want to say at the outset that I present this to you not necessarily as the way to read the Gospel of Mark, but a way to read the Gospel of Mark. And I hope that if you will stay with this program through the week, that you will carry away from the week some insight into Mark that you may never have had before, which can inform the way you'll read this gospel for the rest of your life. I'm assuming this is not the last time you'll read it. I'm going to try to be faithful in translating what Ched Myers is trying to say. As you see, this is a pretty husky book, and it's going to be very difficult, very frustrating to try to do this, frustrating for me and maybe frustrating for you. The book is a very thoroughly researched book. Ched Myers has acquainted himself with virtually all of the biblical scholarship on the Gospel of Mark over many, many centuries, and come to a conclusion about what this book is all about, why it was written and how it was written and under what circumstances and how we ought to interpret it. Stay with me in that, if you will, and don't become too discouraged. If it's unclear at any point, I hope you'll be sure to ask, and we can stop and make sure that it's better understood. Before we do that, though, I thought it'd be kind of interesting to find out what you already know about the Gospel of Mark. Can you just share that? I'm going to stand up so I can see you people. What do you already know about the Gospel of Mark?
It's the second gospel.
It's the second Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. It's the second.
It's the one that omits the nativity.
Pardon me?
It's the gospel that leaves out the nativity.
Yes, actually two of them do.
Oh.
The Gospel of John does not have any information about the early life of Jesus either. Only Matthew and Luke give us the insight into what traditionally is believed to be the first 30 years of Jesus' life. Mark, the Gospel of Mark, actually spends a third of the Gospel of Mark is on 7 days. The Passion Week, the Holy Week, as we think of it in our church year. But that's true. There is no birth narrative in Mark.
It's written,
starts with the baptism.
It's written for believers.
Yes. When we think about why it was written, we're getting into the interpretive stuff. So let's just let that hang.
Because there's no resurrection. There's no. It's written with people that already knew he was resurrected.
One of the problems in the Gospel of Mark is the way it ends, the way it concludes. Ched Myers believes, as I think the best scholars do, that the Gospel of Mark ends with chapter 16, verse 8. But if you look in the Bibles you have in front of you, you'll find that there are two alternative endings beyond that. There are two different additions, the term is often used, to the Gospel of Mark. One of them is the short ending and the other is the long ending. Often called that. And if you stay with me through the week, well, at the end of the week, we will discover why Ched Myers thinks that both of those endings are not a part of the original gospel. And but it disturbs a lot of people that because it seems to end so abruptly. And if you take the Gospel of Mark without those additional endings, there are no post-resurrection appearances of Jesus. no post-resurrection appearances. And that's kind of distressing to some people. Okay. Yeah.
He's very direct, to the point.
To the point, very fast.
A lot of extraneous.
A very rapid pace. The word immediately appears many, many times in Mark. Immediately. Bing, 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 bing. Jesus is on the way. That term will. You'll notice on the kiosk that that's the title for our third session together. On the way. That term is used many times. There's very little of Jesus preaching and teaching in Mark. There are only two places where there's an extended discourse, and we'll see those as we go along. But most of the Gospel of Mark is action, not words. Very little parabolic material in Mark. Not like Luke, where you have the parable of the Good Samaritan and the prodigal son and many, many parables in Luke and in Matthew. They're not in Mark. Okay, what else do you know about Mark?
Mark's the oldest, is it, or the first?
Yeah, it's believed, pretty generally believed, that the Gospel of Mark is the oldest of the four Gospels, and that both Matthew and Luke are very dependent on Mark. A lot of Mark's material is replicated in Matthew and Luke. Some of it virtually word for word. So Mark is generally believed to be the oldest, and Ched Myers agrees with that scholarly opinion.
And the epistles predate Mark, don't they?
Yeah, Paul's letters are the earliest material in the New Testament. The Epistle of the Galatians is often believed to be the earliest book that we have in the New Testament, the first of them to be written. Yeah. But of the four Gospels, Mark is the oldest. And there's been a lot of scholarly debate as to whether it was written before or after 70 AD. Now, what happened in 70 AD?
All of Jerusalem was destroyed.
The city of Jerusalem was destroyed.
And the Jewish scholars, didn't they gather to try to decide which books they were going to have in their canon? Was that soon afterwards?
There's the development of the Hebrew canon antedates the life of Jesus. So that comes earlier. But the crucial thing for us to know is that in the year 70 AD, the Roman armies destroyed the city of Jerusalem. And from the Jewish standpoint, the most crucial thing in that was that the temple was destroyed. And the temple was the center of the religious life of the Jews. After 70 AD, the attention of Jewish religious life shifts from the temple in Jerusalem to the synagogues, which were located in the various towns and cities, not only in Palestine, but throughout the Middle East, the so-called diaspora, the Jewish people who lived all over the Roman Empire. That destruction of the city of Jerusalem was the climax of a four-year war. In 66 AD, there was a powerful effort on the part of Jewish people to rise up, you know, with military forces against the Romans to try to drive the Romans out of Palestine, to reclaim their country for themselves. They're often referred to as the Jewish nationalists. And a lot of guerrilla warfare going on during that time. But in 70, Emperor Titus sent his massive Roman forces in, and they just destroyed Jerusalem, burned down the temple, destroyed the temple. And Ched Myers believes that the Gospel of Mark was written just prior to 70, during that four-year war. So it's very important from his standpoint that we read Mark as coming out of a time of great turmoil, great violence, a scary, frightening time. People were very afraid. And, well, We'll get into that in a minute. What else do you know about Mark? Anything else? It's also the shortest of the four Gospels. 16 chapters only. That's part of that rapid fire, quick action that characterizes this book. Well, I think that gets the major things that, and what we've said so far is stuff that virtually all biblical scholars agree about in terms of Mark. Now what I want to do is to get into some of the more distinctive things that characterize Meyer's approach to Mark. And I'd like to do that by monologuing for a while, if you'll forgive me, because I want to lay this out as clearly as I can in admittedly a very brief form to give us a perspective before we get into the text itself. Earlier this morning when we met, we didn't even get into the text. And I'm not worried about that. If we can get this perspective in front of us, then we can move through the text more rapidly and see why Mark writes in the way he appears to write. The subtitle of this book is A Political Reading of Mark's Story of Jesus. A Political Reading of Mark's Story of Jesus. Now don't confuse that with party politics, Republicans, Democrats. We'll see as we go along why he chooses to call it a political reading of the Gospel of Mark. And I just want to repeat that I offer this to you not as the way to read Mark, but a way to read Mark. And just immerse yourself in this, if you will, during this week, if you stay with these early morning sessions, and allow yourself to sort of play with this perspective. Don't worry too much about whether you agree with it or not. Suspend judgment at that point if you can. And we can talk about what we agree with or not agree with in this. That's okay. But let's not get into any big battles about whether Ched Meyers is right or wrong. Let's just try to hear what he's trying to say and go along with it. The person we call Mark, according to Meyers' point of view, lived in a rural community in northern Palestine. Do you have the map of Palestine in your minds? You can draw Palestine very easily. Just go like this and make a little thing like this. And then you have the Sea of Galilee up here and the Jordan River, and down here is the Dead Sea. That's not in scale. The northern part of, this is at the time of Jesus, the northern part of Palestine was called Galilee. The borders are not very clear, they're fuzzy between these three sections. The middle section was called Samaria. Remember the Good Samaritan? And the southern part was called Judea. A town that will be very important to us, to our reading of Mark, is the city of Capernaum, which is located on the northern part of the Sea of Galilee. And Jerusalem is right down here in Judea, and Bethlehem and Bethany. There are, Ched Meyers suggests that there are two books in Mark, book one, book two. He says, don't think of that as two volumes, but there are two major sections. The first section of the Gospel of Mark has Jesus in and around Galilee. If you looked at the kiosk, the title we've given to tomorrow's session is the Capernaum Campaign, the city of Capernaum. And the second section of the Gospel of Mark has Jesus in Judea. We'll see that more clearly as we go along.
I think if you're careful with the meeting.
The traditional understanding of Mark by biblical scholars has been that the author of this gospel was John Mark, who traveled with Paul on his missionary journeys. And it's often been suggested that the young man who ran away naked when Jesus was arrested was Mark. That little one-verse incident is recorded only in the Gospel of Mark. And some have suggested that that was Mark's way of saying, I was there. I was an eyewitness. Now, Ched Myers doesn't get into that. He doesn't discuss the question of who was the author in this book. But he does take a minority view as to where Mark was when he wrote. The traditional scholarly position has been that Mark was writing from the city of Rome, that he had followed Paul to the end of Paul's life in the book of Acts, to the city of Rome, and that he's writing from Rome. Myers takes the view that some other scholars have taken, that Mark was a part of a community that existed up here in Galilee, and he's writing from Galilee. And this community was a very tightly knit group of people. Let's call them Jesus people. They were people, you're aware that the early Christians were almost all Jews. You know that. And there were some Gentiles. Like, it's believed that Luke was a Gentile, a Greek. But most of the early Christians were Jews. And in the early years, there was not a clear distinction between Judaism and Christianity. Christianity was a sect within Judaism, if you want to think of it that way. They were Jewish people who followed Jesus. So think of the Mark community as a tightly knit group of Jewish people who followed Jesus. Now this was a community that had a very clear agenda, a very clear focus. And that agenda was a commitment to a vision of a new world, of a new kind of world, where the whole order of things would be turned upside down. A radical change will take place. they were committed to the equality of people, of human beings. Men and women were equal. That's a very radical idea in the ancient world. In the ancient world, you women would not be here. Only the men would be here studying the Bible. You women would be out doing women's work. You know. And women were looked upon as property, as vessels for male enjoyment, producers of kids, and carers of the hearth. The men were the people who had status in society. This radical community, Markan community, Jesus community, believed firmly that needed to be overthrown. Radically believed in the equality of men and women. And this comes out in the Gospel of Mark, as we'll see. And also equality between Jews and Gentiles. Now that was an equally radical notion. The Jewish people believed that they were the chosen people of God, and Gentiles were really looked upon as subhuman by the Jewish, very proud Jewish people, especially the leadership among the Jews. And here's a community now that is intercultural. This week is supposed to be the Intercultural Week at Holden, so I get this little theme note in here. Think of the Markan community as intercultural in the profoundest sense, that these people are equal. And I said earlier that it was probably a Jewish community, probably not. There were probably Gentiles who were a part of that community, the Markan community up in Galilee. And also the poor, very strongly believe that the poor were being trod upon by the rich in their society, and identified with the needs of the poor. So you have this clear vision in this community of equality of people, rich and poor, Gentiles and Jews, and male and female, and children. The children are to be honored, which was also a very radical notion in that society, that you pay much attention to children. And you see that coming through in the Gospel of Mark. Now that agenda, that clear vision, meant that this community was radically, I keep using that word, radically opposed to all the forces that were contrary to that. They were opposed to, certainly were opposed to the Roman militias that were occupying their country, the military, the pompous military with their soldiers and their armor and holding the people down. They were very much opposed to that. They were also opposed to those Jewish military forces that were trying to overthrow the Romans. The Jewish nationalists that I mentioned earlier, because this community was committed to nonviolence. They believed that a violent response to violence was equally wrong, was equally inappropriate. And not simply, and this is important, not simply because they would not succeed. Not just because they would not succeed, but because this community believed that the only way that was effective in bringing about a new and better world was nonviolence. Think of Martin Luther King or Gandhi. Martin Luther King did not preach nonviolence only because he believed that if the black people took up arms against the American forces, that they would be beaten down and it would be unsuccessful. I mean, it wasn't a pragmatic decision that led them to nonviolence. It was the belief that nonviolence is the way and the only way, the only effective way, and not only the only effective way, but the only moral way to bring about a new world, to bring about the change that they sought. So it's that kind of commitment to nonviolence as the way that this Markan community lived. So they were opposed to both of the factions that were warring against each other in that four-year war. And they were also opposed to the Jewish authorities that were centered in the temple in Jerusalem. And there were three different parties of these Jewish authorities that appear in the Gospel of Mark. One of them is what's the people that are called the Herodians, who were named after King Herod. There was a whole family of Herods. Remember Herod in the birth narrative of Jesus. And there were some Jewish people who believed very strongly that the Herods were the ones who were going to bring the best kind of life for them, the best society for them, and centered their political attachments to the Herods. But the Herods were very corrupt. It was a very corrupt family. And so this Markan community saw no hope in the Herodians at all. But they'll appear in the story. Then there were the scribes. And the scribes are always come off as the bad guys in the Gospel of Mark. These were, some have called them the PhDs of the time. These were the learned people, the people who knew the Torah, the Old Testament scriptures, chapter and verse, backward and forward, and very proud of that. I mean, they're the ones who really know what the will of God is. And the Markan community just felt that their whole way of looking at the world was crazy. Pit themselves against them in all kinds of ways. So there's enmity between the scribes and these Jesus people up in Galilee. And then the other group is the elders, so-called. We meet the Sadducees, were part of the elders, from Ched Meyer's point of view. The elders were the respected leaders in the synagogues and in the temple in Rome. And temple in Jerusalem, excuse me, not in Rome. Again, a group of people that are constantly at enmity with the Mark community. Then there's another group. There's a group of people who believed that the society, the social situation in Palestine needed to be changed, but were committed to a reformist way of going about that. They basically saw society as pretty decent, pretty good, but it needed to be changed in certain respects. They were the liberals of that day, as distinguished from the radicals who wanted to change the whole thing upside down. One of those groups was the Essenes. I'm giving you Meyer's interpretation now. The Essenes you're familiar with from the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Essenes were people who gave up on the society and withdrew into their colony out in the desert. Think of the Hutterites or the Mennonites in our religious history in the United States. And the other group was the Pharisees.
I hear he's a good guy, you guys. Well, we can tell they're bad guys. They were some good guys.
We have a stereotype of the Pharisees that's really not accurate. We often think of the Pharisees as wicked, cruel, corrupt. They were not. They were very noble people, highly educated, and leaders. But they were people who, from the standpoint of the Markan community, were satisfied with kind of tinkering things rather than understanding that the whole system had to be revolutionized radically from the ground up, as Myers puts it. I'm going to stop there, see what's happening to you so far. This is what characterizes the Markan community, situated up in the north. I didn't say, but I must say, that this was also a rural community, a peasant community, with, Meyer says, an anti-city bias. They looked upon the cities as corrupt, the centers of corruption, something like Thomas Jefferson, if you know Thomas Jefferson.
Well, of these different groups that you listed on the board, how aware were they of the Markan community?
Pardon me?
Of these different groups that you've listed on the board, how aware were they of the Markan community?
I don't know that I can respond to that, except to say that these are the people who show up in the story that Mark is writing as opposed to Jesus. And if you ask how or where were they of Jesus, they were very aware of Jesus.
But I'm thinking of this particular community.
Yeah, and that I can't respond to. I don't know. I don't know that he deals with that issue. Could I ask why you asked the question? I'm not sure I understand.
You were speaking of enmity between these two groups. I didn't know if that was just going out in one direction, how the Markan community was responding to the world around them, or if these groups and the world around them were even aware of this group, of this small group, this small community, which wanted to reform and transform the world. It's a two-way street or just a one-way street?
Let's hold that. I'm not sure I know how to respond to that. It's not part of the gospel story, Mark's story, to talk about his own community, but rather to talk about Jesus and the community that Jesus was developing as a prototype of there and as a forerunner of the community to which Mark belonged. What Mark is doing, the person we call Mark, is doing, is writing a tract. That's how I think of it. That's not Meyer's word. Writing a tract for the purpose of encouraging his community to be strong in the face of all of these forces. And the kind of discouragement that that community would experience from time to time. Burnout, a weariness in being faithful to the vision that they had. And the defections that would happen. Myers pictures this community, it's very fragile. And he believes that Mark portrays Jesus' community as being fragile. What after all happened to this community of disciples, ultimately? You all know what happened to them. Ultimately, by the time Jesus' life is over, what happened to these guys? They all scrammed, right? Peter denied Jesus, Judas betrayed him, and all the disciples left when Jesus was crucified. So Mark is portraying Jesus' community as being very fragile, very tenuous. And yet, as we'll see, if you stay with me through the week, we see when we get to the end of the gospel, and this is the exciting thing about Myers seeing Mark ending with 16:8. This week, read the whole gospel in one sitting. Read the whole thing. And then think about 16:8. From Myers' standpoint, that's the climax of the whole story. And rather than seeing it as Mark dying one day or getting tired or losing his computer and just stopping, like some scholars have seen it, that Mark just gave up and quit in the middle of the story, Myers said, no, that's the climax of the story. See if you can figure that out as you read it. And I mean, he sees it as the hope in the whole story. He asks the question, why would the story of this itinerant preacher, Jesus of Nazareth, be called gospel, good news, when the whole thing goes to pieces? It all goes to hell.
What was the relationship up here? Sorry. Relationship in the Acts of the Apostles.
I thought you were God.
In the Acts of the Apostles, when they're talking about they sold all they had and had a communal lifestyle and they divided up the labor and served and preached and ministered, what was the relationship between that group and the Markham people?
You know, that's a question I want to ask Chad Myers because he never talks about that in this volume. There is no connection made in this volume between this Jesus people, not his term, my term, community up in Galilee, and the other early Christian communities that we hear about in the book of Acts, in the Gospel, in the Acts of the Apostles. And I find that to be a serious omission. I wish he'd done more with that. To be the first volume. He has a second volume that he's working on now, and it may be that he'll get into that some more in there. I don't know. So I can't respond to that from the standpoint of Myers' interpretation. Yeah?
You said this was a minority view of who Mark was, and does he draw on certain evidence of the existence of this community? And you don't have to go into a lot of detail, but I just wonder if we know about it from other sources.
Let me tell you, everything I say to you, this guy documents thoroughly in this big volume. And I can't possibly get into all the documentation on it. I encourage you to read the book. Sorry about that. I couldn't do it even if I had time to do it, because I'd have to go back and review his documentation with great care to respond to it. So what I'm really doing is generalizing across the top of the perspective that he gives us on that. Excellent question. Yeah?
I'm curious about the duration of the Markham community and the size.
The duration of it? Boy, you people ask wonderful questions. I don't remember that he speculates about that. What he's doing is What he's doing is telling us what Mark is doing in writing this account. And what the circumstances were within which it was written, to give us a perspective on the reading of it. But he doesn't, there may be something in here that I don't remember about that, but I don't think he gets into the question of how of the survival of this community.
It was a hopeful community, despite being outnumbered?
Yes, very hopeful. There's a lot of belief in the reality of what they of their vision. I'm going to use that word. I don't think he uses that word so much. I think of it as a vision. A lot of belief in the vision and belief in the effectiveness of their approach in the vision. But an awareness that there's an enormous price to be paid to pull this off. When Jesus calls the disciples, immediately in chapter 1, Peter, James, and John, and Andrew are called. And they're fishing with their with Zebedee, their father. And they leave their dad, they leave the fish, they leave the boats, they leave everything. Their life is totally changed. And they are 100% committed to following Jesus. And that's what Mark is saying to this community. That we've got to hold together. We've got to be consistent in our commitment to Jesus. It's Jesus who gives them this vision of all the things I've mentioned, equality, anti-oppressive forces, all of that. It's Jesus who gives them the vision, and we need to be clear about that. If you want to think about it this way, there are levels. Mark records the story of Jesus calling the disciples into this arduous life, dedicated life. And by recording Jesus calling the disciples, Mark is calling his community into the dedicated life, committed life. And Myers is writing his book about Mark's story of Jesus calling the disciples in order to call us into that kind of discipleship, what he calls radical discipleship. Okay? So the intention in writing this book, Myers writing his book, is to call the church, the existing Jesus community today, into radical discipleship. Into caring about those, that vision, which he believes Jesus is holding in front of us. That to be faithful to Jesus is to give your life to the renewal of the world, the renewal of society, not in a tinkering way, not just to kind of fix it up here and there and here and there, but to revolutionize society.
Follow up on that point. Mm-hmm. That's why it's so important when we look at Mark not to look at for the details, like how long did it last, how big was it, because that's not his purpose. It's the call, as you said, and those folks who make those kinds of calls really aren't interested in those kinds of details about how even the other communities 30 miles were dealing with it. They didn't know. I mean, we talk about what was happening with in Jerusalem in the Acts of the Apostles. It's very unlikely that they could even know. 30 miles to us is nothing, but to them it could be a lifetime away. A place they've never been or maybe even heard of for some of the peasantry.
They are not likely to know about Corinth or Thessalonica, way out there, out in the Roman Empire. There was some exchange that happened among the early Christian congregations, but it was very minimal. As people traveled, they would tell stories to each other. But it's not, thank you, there's not a whole lot of communication going on.
No faxes.
No faxes, yeah, right. Well, let's see. I think it's very important that we keep in mind, as we read Mark now this week, that the world out of which this tract comes is a very volatile, turbulent, frightening world. People are being killed, executions are happening, crosses are erected, torture and death surrounds everybody. Everybody's afraid. Very frightening time. Very, very frightening time. Just to read you one sentence out of Myers. It was not Mark's purpose to offer a dispassionate account of his world. He was involved in a fierce ideological struggle with his opponents in a world he assumed his audience knew, like we don't know it. Thus, he employs shorthand, parody, and caricature. There's stuff going on in this gospel, says Myers, with code language that is not immediately evident to us, but which the people at that time would have some sense of, even though it wasn't stated in a clear and prosaic fashion. Just to illustrate, in the very first verses of Mark, whom do we meet immediately?
John the Baptist.
And how is John described?
Loincloth,
honey, locusts, all that stuff. Myers says, isn't it interesting? Mark spends as much time talking about his costume as he does about his message. Now, why does he do that? Because, he says, that description of a person would immediately call forth in the minds of his readers, who? Elijah. Just as if I were to say, and Myers uses this illustration, just as if I were to say, the man with the stovepipe hat and the black tails, who would it be?
Lincoln.
Abraham Lincoln. It didn't take you 30 seconds to figure that out. That came immediately to mind. Myers says, when those people read Mark's description of John, Elijah. Immediate, just like that. Now that's the kind of code language and nuance and implication that the author could use, which it takes us some time to unravel. But for those folks who knew that story of Elijah, as well as you and I know the story of Lincoln probably better, it would come to them immediately. And we'll see as we go along a number of places where that is also the case. Anything else you want to ask about? Anything else unclear here?
A little bit. Farcical, but I see the little tinkering that you talk about with the groups like the Pharisees is surprisingly resembling mainline denominational churches.
That's right.
Content to work within present societal, political, economic structures and tinker away while there's really no vitality in the church itself. The people are looking for something, but the church is not leading.
Well, I thank you for that. And I think if we take seriously what is being laid before us this week, I hope we will make those connections to our own world. to the mainline churches, as you say, and to our society as a whole. The Latin American bishops, Catholic bishops, when they met in Medine several years ago, came up with the expression,
liberation theology?
Yeah, the expression was, come on, Smith. With regard to the poor, you've heard all of you. Tell me, Mark.
Solidarity.
Solidarity with the poor, but there's another expression.
The option for the poor.
Preferential option for the poor. That's the expression I want. Preferential option for the poor.
What was that supposed to mean?
It meant that the Latin American bishops were saying the task of the church is to relate to the poor preferentially.
Okay.
Even more so than they would to the rich. In the past, the Latin American church, they were acknowledging, had always allied with the rich and would say to the poor, well, I'm sorry you're poor, but that's the deck of cards God dealt you, and someday you'll get your wealth in heaven. What the bishops were saying is that the church has to ally itself with the poor, and in Latin America, the poor are abjectly poor, helplessly poor, to help them to arise to at least a decent kind of living situation with some kind of hopefulness for their children in a way that's not presently the case. So they were really calling upon their own church to make a radical shift in its agenda. Now, it hasn't done that altogether. There are some bishops in Latin America that have been far more faithful to that call than others have been. But that was the vision that they set in front of themselves. And we think about this vision in somewhat of the same nature, that it's really saying the whole thing is wrong. The whole thing is wrong. And it has to be radically changed, not just mildly changed, but radically upset, turned upside down. And that's not good news to those of us who are on the top of the pile. Change, I often say, change is hope for people on the bottom of the pile. But change is a threat to people on the top of the pile. And we Americans are on the top of the pile across the world, thinking interculturally this week. And for us to think about Jesus leading us into a radical change of the whole system around the world is very threatening to our well-being. And it's not surprising that the people who were on the top of the pile in Jesus' day were as resistant of that vision as we're likely to be. Does that make the connection somewhat? Yeah, please.
I just wanted to say, I think the bishops even went a step further by saying the scripture itself that displayed this preferential option for the poor and not just an edict again from a church hierarchy.
Good point.
So that the poor themselves have the scripture again in their hands the way perhaps even Luther put it into people's hands, which was the most radical thing of all.
Yeah, that's right. Now, I was thinking while reading Myers how subversive Martin Luther was. We don't always like that word, subversive. That sounds a little spooky, a little like spies and stuff. But there are many things that are subversive when you think about it. And Luther was certainly, Luther nailed the 95 theses on the castle church door in Wittenberg. That was a subversive act. And it became more subversive than he realized it was going to be. Because it really did have the effect of flipping that whole thing upside down. And it's not a bad thing for us to think about Jesus calling us into being subversive of our own society, of our own world. Maybe for some of us that's kind of scary talk, and we're not quite there yet, but think about that. It depends, of course, upon what it is we're subverting. And So subversiveness in and of itself is not bad. We'll see in Mark how subversive the teachings of Jesus were vis-a-vis the Roman powers, the occupying colonial powers, and how subversive Jesus' words were, his teachings were, and his actions were vis-a-vis the Jewish authorities of his time and the Jewish practices. And that comes through very clearly. And I think we, maybe as Christians, are not terribly surprised that Jesus would subvert some of the Jewish things, like the Sabbath laws, for example. I mean, that's perfectly okay. After all, we worship on Sunday instead of Saturday. We play baseball on Sunday, and they didn't. You know, we're okay with subverting the Jewish Sabbath laws. But in being okay with that, we have to be aware of how radical that was. I mean, that was a total revolution of the understanding of God and the world that these people had. A total revolution of how they understood the way God works with people. So what Jesus is calling the people to is an upsetting of the apple cart, a very important sense. Well, we got to quit.